Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson. Today, I will be talking again to Kim Stanley Robinson, one of the highlights of my year every year, and I hope for you as well. We're talking about his multi-generational spaceship novel, Aurora, and we just started talking, and I didn't do an intro, so here's the intro. Also, before the interview, a quick favor to ask. The show is going to be 5 years old in September. I'm feeling celebratory. I noticed that on Apple Podcasts, the show has 75 or so reviews. And so I'm just hoping in the next 6 months or so, we can push that up to 100. So if you can, please give a 5-star rating or review to the show. Ratings anywhere else, including Spotify, help as well. But Apple's the big... Apple's the big near monopoly cartel in podcasting. So that's where it helps the most. Sorry to keep you from the interview. The music, which you're about to hear, is by David Hill. We've done this plenty of times. Thank you again, as always, for doing this. And I'll say, let's get started unless there's anything you want to say before we go.
No, thank you. I can just say this. It's a pleasure to talk about Aurora.
Okay. Well, yeah, let's start there. Do you not normally get to talk about Aurora?
Well, it's not like it. Basically, it still gets talked about, but only... you know, one time out of 20 compared to talking about Ministry for the Future.
Right.
But that's true of all the rest of my books at this point. Ministry for the Future still dominates my interactions with the world big time. And so even the Mars Trilogy and then New York 2140, Aurora, these get discussed, but much less so.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think this has come up in most of our conversations is the way that Ministry of the Future has sort of taken over. And if you have not published another novel since Ministry of the Future, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, because our first conversation was about the High Sierra book, which did come out after Ministry of the Future, but was not a novel. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into it. So let me start by describing. And listener, if you haven't read Aurora, beware of spoilers. I hope you can enjoy this conversation if you haven't read it. But when Stan and I have done this in the past, we've by necessity and desire ranged over the entire book, including the end. So Aurora is a book. I mean, I have the hardcover in front of me. It says. Our voyage from Earth began generations ago. Now we approach our new home, Aurora. That's all it says on the back of the book. But the arc of the book is not about approaching a new home. It is a book about a group of colonists in a living starship, by which I don't mean that the ship itself is alive, although we'll get to the ship's computer and its questions of consciousness, but a ship that carries within it an attempt at an entire biome with the attempt for the people from Earth to land on a new planet or moon, depending on what they find when they get there, and create an entirely new civilization that is habitable and has... an ecosystem over time similar to Earth's, and they fail. It doesn't happen, or rather, after an initial setback, the colony is divided, and different groups go their separate ways. But the protagonist, or there's a line in there, something like the character with a high degree of protagonicity, or something like that, is with the group that. Returns to Earth. And so Aurora is in some ways, an inversion of expectations, at least from the back of the book that say a new home. It's an inversion in some ways of the Mars trilogy. It's an inversion of one of the strongest currents of all of science fiction, which is the colonizing of new worlds. It is a story of a colonization of new worlds that doesn't succeed. And I will also say before I let you speak, I hadn't read it before our conversation, and I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I thought it was great. It was a thriller. I loved reading it, and thank you so much for taking the time again to speak to me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And yes, your description is accurate. It takes the story of the generational starship, which means. Sub light speed, moving small world that has been popular in science fiction at least since Robert Heinlein's Universe, and became a kind of a meme or a way of talking about inhabiting the stars without invoking faster than light travel. And like someone said to me, it's like taking a plastic model of the USS Enterprise of the Star Trek people and smashing it with a baseball bat on the driveway. a sweeping attempt to say it's not possible even to do it in the way that's been described in science fiction. If you look closely at what that project would entail, it can't work. So it isn't just that it doesn't work in this particular case, but this novel is a particular describing a general situation. We're not going to the stars. So it got a lot of shit from the science fiction community. Some of even of my fellow authors banded together to write a rebuttal critique of the book that was badly conceived and badly executed, I have to say, but you can never really answer back to critics in print. So yes, I would say the fundamental problem is the stars are too far away, farther away than we usually think. And I picked the nearest one that looks habitable, which is Tau Ceti. That star has five planets circling it. This is one of the great glories of our telescopes to have seen that. And I had to postulate because these planets are like five times the size of the Earth at their smallest. And I had to postulate that one of those had a moon around it that was approximately the size of the Earth, which was discovered by even better telescopes, in order to make Tau Ceti my test case, being as close as it could be. Because Alpha Centauri, which is only 4 light years away, is a weird little dwarf star with nothing. Well, it may in fact have a planet really close to it, but none of that is inhabitable by humans, even visible from here. We can tell that. Tau Ceti, not so much, but I picked it as a test case. Even the closest ones are too far away.
Yeah, so I didn't know about that that rebuttal, but I'm not surprised. I was speaking to my wife this morning before our conversation, and I said to her, you know, the trickiest thing about this book is that I have no doubt that people see it as a betrayal of the ideals of science fiction. I think that is, and I mean, I have seen this like in comments maybe on your Facebook page or something, of people have said like, Kim Stanley Robinson is supposed to tell us how to make a new world out in space. And now that he's telling us that we can't make a new world in space, I think there's a sense that I use the word betrayal, or another word would be giving up on the ideals of science fiction. And I'm happy to hear that was confirmed. I'm not happy to hear that people wrote a letter decrying you, but that my sense that this book would have caused a shitstorm that it did. Obviously, I wasn't following that when it happened. And so I guess I just, you know, you can talk more about that. I guess this isn't a question, but thoughts about it's obvious to me that this is your attempt to be true to the ideals of science fiction, but you've gotten a result that people who grew up on the Enterprise or even the Mars trilogy or C.J. Cherry or Ian M. Banks's The Culture, any of these far flung senses of a wide ranging human settlement of the galaxy. This is you saying, at least without faster than light travel, which faster than light travel remains a a physics problem that's not even worth discussing right now, it's just not going to happen.
Right. It's true. But I want to make some distinctions here. The solar system is within reach. So we have the planets and asteroid belts of the solar system. And if you want to really get wild, you could talk about the Oort cloud of ice objects that are further out, but nowhere near as far out as the nearest stars. And also, another distinction to make here, the galaxy is a great story space. So if I was to tell you that Middle Earth is not real and can't happen, we can't go to Middle Earth, you don't immediately say, oh my God, you've wrecked the integrity of Middle Earth. And Ian Banks, amongst many others, is a great storyteller. And even the story of the generational starship, I refer you to Gene Wolfe's The Book of the Long Sun, which is four volumes, although they arrive at a double planet. Wolfe liked double planet systems orbiting together, as in the fifth head of Cerberus. They arrive, and then there's the Book of the Short Sun, which is three more volumes. These seven volumes constitute one big long novel, which Wolfe was masterful at. And that is a great novel. One of his best, in fact, it's my favorite of all of his novels, and more so than the Book of the New Sun or any of his later or earlier works. It's a masterpiece of a complicated inter-starship adventure and moral questioning. Great novel. Ian Banks is a great novel. Ken MacLeod. There's a lot of what gets called space opera because they are zooming out into space, and in the 30s they were zipping around without much explanation. And as a story space, you can tell great stories there. But what Aurora is saying is we're never actually going to do it. It's just as mythical as Middle Earth. And that in itself was a shock to people because there was this old phrase from Tsiolkovsky, the Russian cosmologist, astronomer and space cadet. Earth is humanity's cradle, but you're not meant to stay in your cradle forever. But he said that before Hubble, and Hubble's constant. And we didn't know how far the stars were away when he said that. He could imagine rocket ships. He could imagine getting there like you get to the moon. But the distances are impossible to traverse. Now, my novel makes that case indirectly through the course of the problems that characters have to deal with, which are intractable. But I wrote an essay afterwards for Cory Doctorow when he was still part of the editor board of Boing Boing, called Our Generational Starships Will Sink. And in that essay, I outlined the case as being, if I can remember it, the problems are physical, in that if you get up to a tenth of light speed, it's harder than hell to slow down again. Biological, our gut microbiomes depend on a healthy bacterial load of the rest of the Earth, and we're tied to Earth by biology. And then sociological, you would have to have a fascistic state to keep population control and have everybody do their jobs and be educated, and people born on the starship would be as if born in prison. And that brings us to the psychological, which is that individuals would go crazy in a confined space like that, 1 trillionth the size of Earth, essentially born in prison, die in prison, never get to the planet. And then my essay went on, and I don't want to go on too long, but we can lay out the basis for the rest of the discussion here and maybe get to the novel itself and the characters. But when you get to a planet, is it alive or is it dead? Well, if it's dead, it probably doesn't have oxygen, and you have to terraform a planet from a starship, so 1 trillionth the size. You'd have to wait in that starship another extra 200 to 20,000 years to terraform that planet. If it's alive, you may be an alien that the living creatures of that planet want to eat or are poisonous to us. So alive or dead, and then it could be like Mars. We don't know if it's alive or dead yet. And that would be true if we got to a planet that looked blank. We still couldn't be sure. So arrival, even to Tau Ceti, after 200 years with a semi-crazed crew and a falling apart starship, does not solve your problem. You still got a horrific problem that you can't solve. So what I did was I put a realist's magnifying glass on this idea of a story space that everybody was taking to be a given. And it's sort of like, not just crashing the USS Enterprise with a baseball bat. It's more like saying this whole story space is a fiction, like Middle Earth. Get used to it. And even that was really objectionable because people have used going to the stars as a humanist replacement for religion, for immortality. The species will go everywhere. Some people write like these long-termism people, because they are not scientifically educated people. We will not only go everywhere in this galaxy, we will go to other galaxies. And they don't have the slightest notion how far away one galaxy is from the next. It's just that kind of foo-for-ah, that kind of fundamental ignorance about reality itself needed to be slapped around a little bit. And it made a good story, too.
So it's a fantastic story, and I agree that we should turn to it quickly, but I have to ask you, turn to it soon. I have to ask you the question that definitely, I'm sure I would not have liked this book if I had read it when I was discovering space opera, when I was a teenager. Part of what I would have thought, I know I said this in discussions with friends like in high school, is that there's this thing called hard science fiction, which is about sort of extrapolating the science that we can understand and taking it to the next steps. And then there's soft science fiction, which you could say negatively is science fiction that doesn't really think or understand science. It doesn't care that much about science. How I would have defended soft science fiction, though, would have been something like, it assumes that we are going to solve problems that right now seem insoluble. And I would have said something like, that's what science always does. It solves insoluble problems. So that's the last note I want on this wider question before we get to the novel is,
yeah,
what would you say to that response of like, oh, well, sure, the biome is a difficult problem, but surely 500 years from now, we'll know better how to handle gut microbes.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because I want to point out that hard science fiction is a politicized, defensive, and also passive-aggressive name bestowed on themselves by hard science fiction writers. And what they mean is, we're hard in our science. We stick to the facts. Meanwhile, they have fast and light travel and aliens speaking English the moment you talk to them. Hard science fiction is a fantasy just as much as any other. And when they talked about soft science fiction, what they really meant was squishy people like women and English majors. They meant Le Guin and me, and others like them who were studying biology instead of the hard physics of the hard science fiction writers. And so that was always bullshit. An aggressive stance within the science fiction community to claim precedence, like we are the pure thing. And some of them would say, well, we play tennis with the net up, and the rest of you are playing tennis with the net down. And I said to one of them on stage once in a panel, a frenemy of mine, well, yes, but you play tennis with the net up, but you have a magical net alterer that you can point at the net and you can shoot the tennis ball right through the net anytime you want. And what's with this faster than light travel bullshit? And they had no answer for that. They just waved their hands and began to claim their physics degrees made them good SF writers, which is by no means a guarantee. So, in other words, that's not a real distinction. That's a political war within science fiction to try to pile up on people who supposedly didn't know the sciences, while the people who did know the sciences were ignoring them left, right, and center. So, no, there isn't. And believe me, I've been called hard science fiction because there's a lot of facts. I've been called soft science fiction. I've been called literary science fiction. I've been called feminist science fiction. These attempts to subdivide science fiction are almost always political battles within science fiction community. They're not real literary distinctions, in other words.
Yeah, I'm so glad I asked that question as well. I agree. I no longer am worried about such questions, but I have to tell you, when I was 15 years old, and I wanted to defend Philip K. Dick against Robert Heinlein, I made lots of distinctions in favor of, quote, soft science fiction.
You could say, I used to say this, they're only hard in their political attitudes in that they're mostly right-wing jerks.
Yeah, that's obvious enough. This is, you know, I've become addicted to this right-wing phrase from, I guess probably from Thatcher, Tina, there is no alternative. That's what they always want to be shouting, both much more. They want to be shouting it politically. There is no alternative. They don't actually mean it with the physics. They'll make up alternatives to the physics, but we have to have strong men leading our space fleets of whatever of the empire. I don't know that sort of thing. Obviously Heinlein is too easy to critique in this case. It's not even worth doing because it's too obvious for anyone who knows anything about Heinlein.
Well, Heinlein is at least a more interesting in that he had fluctuations and weirdnesses. He started out as Crazy Bob Heinlein and had a big interest in nudity and polygamy, and his politics only got rigid and a little fascistic in Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
And before that, there wasn't much that you could tag him with. And he wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, which is some kind of hippie dreamscape. So Heinlein's complicated. But people like Niven and Pornell, they are not complicated. And there was a whole... And besides, although Niven is an excellent writer, Pornell not so much. But those were the guys who were strutting around going, we're the only real true SF writers because we write so hard. And then they had all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But it was a political battle.
Okay, excellent. Yes, I agree. So let's get to the novel. So first, I think we've talked about this before. The structure of this novel, I would say, is in some ways a series of novellas, but it also has a pretty clear narrative through line. So I guess I just wanted to hear about your construction of the novel and how you think it fits together, and then we can talk a bit about the narrator.
Yeah, thanks for that. The chapters are novella length, but they are not distinctly individualized. Mm-hmm. They are sequential chapters of a novel. And I say that because I do have novels made up of novellas in the true sense. In Icehenge, the three parts of Icehenge are individualized novellas that were published separately. In Aurora, you couldn't do that, but these are big, chunky chapters. There's seven of them. The first one is a third-person limited point of view from Freya, who is a young girl at the time, from her point of view in a narrator that is standardized in that you don't notice it, but this narrator is from her point of view. It's a free and direct style. You could call it in literary fiction, but in science fiction, we usually call it third person limited. Okay, but then the second chapter is taken over by the ship's AI quantum computer that is guiding the ship internally and is a very advanced quantum computer. And it is instructed by the mother of Freya, Devi, to keep a narrative account of the voyage. And this, in a sense, it can be interpreted as write a novel. And this is a set of algorithms. It's a quantum computer, but it's still a computer. It's algorithmic, but it is a quantum computer. And I postulated many, many, many qubits to be able to run the starship. But then the people on the starship, generation 2, 3, or 4, because it takes about 200 years to get to Tau Ceti at a speed you can slow down from. In that time, the humans on board don't really understand this quantum computer. And meanwhile, the quantum computer has been given some self-improvement algorithms to try to recursively learn more to take care of its people. And it has this sort of Asimov robotic law, take care of your people and get this mission accomplished. Well, so for me, this was comedy. how do you write a novel? There is no algorithm. And learning it from scratch, as the AI is shown to do in the first maybe 20 to 30 pages, well, really in the first two, in each one of the quantum computer's five chapters, it changes as a narrator and gets more and more like going from Daniel Defoe to Proust or Henry James, more and more wordy, convoluted, thoughtful, etc., philosophical, you might say. Who can say what's going on there? But then the last chapter, it's a bookend structure. The last chapter goes back to Freya, her third-person limited point of view, because at that point, they're back on Earth and the quantum computer is no longer there to narrate. And so I needed that structure for the reader to feel the shape of it, So it couldn't just start with Freya and then completely shift over to the quantum computer's point of view. It needed the bookends, and then there's a narrative point of view shapeliness to it that I quite liked. I had to work that out over quite a bit of time. In fact, I'll end with this. I had a dream while drafting Aurora in which the ship said, I need to be the narrator. And this literally came to me in a dream. And I woke up and I wrote it down in my notebook and I stared at it. And at that point, I had to throw out about 100 pages of a first draft that had been written from the normal third person point of view, because it was a good idea. I mean, it was obviously my idea, but at the dream level. And so I had to go back and rewrite it from the ship's point of view. And that was what made the book more than just a prison novel, something that was interesting for more than just the story it's telling, but also for this problem of the narrator.
Yeah, and I found it delightful reading the ship trying to understand what it means to have a high degree of protagonicity and, you know, the problem of representation, which representation is both a literary problem as well as a well-known political problem. When the ship starts wondering whether or not it has a consciousness and what counts as a consciousness, and rehearses all of the old philosophical arguments that indeed apply to humans as well. And I don't know. I think the dream thing is fascinating, but I do think that the ship narrator and this cobbling together of both a personality and a literary style makes the novel much more interesting than it would have been if you had not made that change. And at some point, you're sort of on these dual tracks, or at least I was as a reader, of like, what's going to happen with this journey and what is happening? It's almost a Bildungsroman. It's almost a coming of age, not for Freya. Freya comes of age fairly early on. It's a coming of age for the ship, even as the ship is a godlike entity for the people.
Well, thank you for that. That's how it felt to me, for sure. There were big questions that came up that wouldn't have been as interesting if they weren't first person point of view. What is agency? And so the ship suddenly has to become, in effect, the sheriff of the town that it is charged to administer. And its basic overriding task, take care of the people inside this thing and the animals, because they have a whole raft of living creatures there to populate the new planet. Take care of all these living creatures. When the living creatures get into a little civil war, what does that mean? What do you do? And how do you be a sheriff and a judge and all these things? And then if you're the computer for a ship, what's your agency? And I had to parse it out. I had to really ponder, well, regulation of air. You could take the air, you can keep the air from going into a particular room. You can kill everybody in that room. You could turn up the amplification on your voice speaking to people, and you could blast their ears until they're just screaming in pain. So the agency of the sheriff was weird, and it was a technical problem for me to figure out, not to mention the difficulties. Well, we'll get to that later. I definitely want to talk to you about the problem of coming back to the solar system at 1/10 of light speed with no fuel to slow down, because that was one of the funnest parts. In fact, that was my hard SF masterpiece that the hard SF writers couldn't handle, that I had scooped them on one of the great stories that hard SF could ever tell. And it was right, because I got advice from my astronomer friends at NASA Ames. So, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah, let's take a moment before we get to the physics, because there's this moment for me. So one of the things that I have been working on and thinking about, I've spoken to you a number of times. I've spoken to my mentor, who is my dissertation director, who's in the liberal political tradition, is this problem of, you know, you always say, you know, anarchy means no rulers, not no rules. And there's a general sense that we need rule of law. It's hard to find people who say we don't need rule of law or some sort of rules. And then the problem is, you know, as we're speaking, what's going on in Minnesota with the ICE raids is both sides are claiming rule of law. Both sides are claiming they are the true defenders of rule of law. Both sides want to say, you know, both sides have guns in a way that they don't on the ship. But this idea that there must be rules and the rules must be enforced is pretty widely held. The question is, the problem is, how do you choose the enforcers? What are the rules by which the rules are enforced? And there's this moment that makes complete sense within the novel you have written, but strikes me would be very dangerous if this idea was applied in the real world, where the ship's AI says, I am the rule of law. I am upholding the Constitution. The coup is over. No guns. And this, I mean, I don't know, it solves the problem, right? It solves this. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, that is a fraught moment. competing claims on the rule of law. I mean, I'll just restrict myself to saying in our current situation in Minnesota, one side is claiming the law that there shouldn't be undocumented immigrants here in this country is being enforced by murdering people, that there's a clear discrepancy there in the two laws involved and being invoked. And it's clear that that ICE and Trump are full of crap when it comes to their claims to being lawful, that this is an excuse to put a fascistic authoritarian government on us. On the other hand, it's interesting comparison. Ship has got a civil war in his hands, and they are caught in a tank where if they fight too much, the whole tank will die. So, and the ship is charged with taking care of them. It does seize executive power in a way in order to enforce a peaceful discussion, saying only peaceful discussions will be allowed here. And if there's anything otherwise, then I'll suck the air out of your room or lock you in. I think that's another thing that the ship decided it could do, was just lock people into different chambers until they talked it out. But it was a fraught moment. And I'll say that one thing, when you said that the book is made of novellas, is I think another way to think of it is it's very plot driven, in that each one of the seven chapters has a plot turn that is rather remarkable compared to what you expected the book to be about. Because they do get to the planet, the moon that they call Aurora. They do go down to it and spend some time there building a first colony. That's an entire novella. And that's usually an entire plot of a science fiction novel. That's just one of the seven chapters. And then suddenly they have the problem with dying there. Then they have the Civil War. Then they have the desperate attempt to get back to Earth as the only possible solution to their dilemma, the only thing that might get them home alive. But of course, the starship is already faltering. So it's a desperate trip home, and even includes the invention of cryo sleep, of hibernation for humans, which they have to invent on the fly in order to put themselves to sleep because the ship has run out of resources to keep them alive. Well, this is much more plot driven than a lot of my novels, at least I found it so. And it was exciting to be telling a story where there were all these twists and turns, and each chapter had to jam in an entire set of activities or points, a lot of action for really what is still a novel about character and about consciousness, but it still had an awful lot of action in it.
Yeah, I should say, you know, I had heard from a friend what this novel was about. And as I was reading it, when they were settling the planet or the moon so successfully, I thought, oh, I must be misremembering. This isn't a story about giving up and turning back at all. So the twist, I mean, congratulations, Dan, you got me. The twist, I did not see it coming, even having been warned by someone, and I was settling in for another version of successful terraforming, which I've seen in both your novels and, of course, many others.
Yes, and I'm a fan of the terraforming novel, as you can well imagine. Given my Mars books. But in this case, I really wanted to press home. From Earth, you could terraform Mars because there's continuous interaction between the two, and a trip that could be shortened to a few weeks if you had a really powerful rocketry. But if you have nothing but a starship 2,000 people and the animals involved and the bacteria involved, and you hit a dead planet, you're in terrible trouble for terraforming that place. You don't have the leverage. You don't have the energy and biological firepower to make that change. You'd be like dropping an eyedropper into the ocean in hopes of changing that entire ocean. And it might work, but only after huge amounts of time had passed where you'd still have to live in your starship. So yeah, I've definitely hid my cards and played them one at a time, like in one of these cards down poker games. And as each chapter changed, the card turned up would be a different than what you expected by a long shot, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, I thought that worked perfectly. And that is why I think saying it has a novella structure, even as it is a clear novel where each chapter leads into the next one, as opposed to sort of having its own arc and then being a different thing, I think it can hold both descriptions. I guess the last thing that I wanted to mention before we get to this, the story of going home and the physics of that, and hopefully we can talk about the end and the ocean if we have time.
Yes.
Is that you say that there's you said just now that they have no choice but to return, and the novel makes it clear that there's no choice but to return, and the people who stay die. And I guess I just want to say, from our perspective, from your perspective, you get to be the voice of God. You're the author, which means authority. From the ship's perspective and from Freya's perspective, who is our window into this world, our two windows are Freya and ship. There's no choice. But if I remember correctly, over half of the people on the ship see a choice and they want to stay.
Yeah.
And this just takes us back to the political problem that you or Ship, if you prefer, writes so eloquently about. I mean, I remember circling. There's one moment where someone says it's not the ship, it's characters discussing, and they say, or maybe it is the ship. Anyways, has there ever been a good way for humans to make group decisions where it works? And someone says, you know, looking at the literature, no, we haven't. I mean, I live in the town of Chapel Hill, and we bought our house to be near an elementary school. And the town has announced they're going to close an elementary school, and no one knows which one. Everyone doesn't want it to be theirs. And let me tell you, there's not a clear way for us to make this group decision.
Right.
So this problem, whether it's the closing of the elementary school or who is going to be in charge of immigration and customs enforcement, or whether or not you have to turn the ship around before everyone dies, this is the hard problem of politics. And it is in some ways insoluble, but The book solves it with its narrative perspective and its narrator, I think.
Yeah, well, there's many things to say about that. One, I too am in a college town, and because housing is so expensive here, young families with young kids can't afford to buy in, and so the elementary schools are losing kids, and therefore they have to close. That's happening in Davis too. The elementary school that my kids went to 25 years ago is going to probably be the one to close. And then to the larger question, well, yes, this is why history is so messy. We're not really good at decision-making. There's many different ways to do it, but one is just it's politics. It's one which can shift over into war. It's one decision at a time, and we don't have a good format for the next one, even though we've tried. And even though there was a post-World War II international order that was set up by a traumatized world community that said, let's not do that again, which is one of the many things that Trump and his crowd is stupidly deconstructing. The international, not so much rule of laws, but norms, treaties, a kind of looser set of, because again, there's no sheriff and no jail. So it's a set of agreements or norms. And that's mainly how we cludge through. In the book, they do split up because there's a group of people that says, look, we are 12 light years from Earth. The ship is already clapped out. You're not going to make it back. We need to go to the next moon over and hope that it's dead. And they have a valid case to make there. It's just that the same problem will face them. So, and the starship is basically like Solomon with the baby. We're going to just cut the starship itself in half. And so that means that you have to imagine that ship has left a part of its capacities or copied itself. And half of the starship goes elsewhere. We don't know where. We never hear back from them. I've been urged to write their story, but that strikes me as a really dismal story because I don't think there's a good outcome for that crowd. But I didn't want to follow it. I wanted to follow Freya and the people who stuck with Freya. Because indeed, you know, this question of Freya, I want to say, Devi, Badim, the family. My friend Karen Fowler said to me once, science fiction has hardly any mother-daughter relations in it. And I'm not sure that's true because of the feminist science fiction of the 1970s and 80s. There's a big body of work there where I'll bet you there's a whole lot of mother-daughter relationships, especially on these all-female planet stories, which are rife and good. I'm reading one now called A Door into Ocean by Jones Lonchesky, which is a fabulously good science fiction novel. I recommend it to you because it comes from 86 and might not be well remembered, but it's an ocean planet that is entirely occupied by female humans, and they have co-evolved with the ocean that covers their entire moon. And then the planet down below is a patriarchal, warlike, male-dominated planet. And it's not as simplistic as that makes it sound, but it is pretty harrowing because the plot is striking. But back to my book, that the one question about island devolution, if you have one population and they are living in a little tank like that, every generation seems to be getting less intelligent, certainly less educated, and attenuating in various ways, getting diseases. And so Freya is suspected of being developmentally slow. She is developmentally slow, but her mom fears that it's going to be permanent her whole life. Freya growing up, the Bildungsroman in chapter maybe 2 or 3, it shows that she is by no means simple-minded or developmentally delayed. She's delayed, but she gets there. And I'm thinking of a great novella by Joseph Conrad called Typhoon, which I recommend to you. Joseph Conrad's Typhoon, the captain of this ship that survives a typhoon through pure stubbornness. And this is a great novella, one of Conrad's best. And I think it's Captain McWhirr, Mac and then W-H-I-R-R. And he's not actually worrying very quickly. He's pretty slow in his speech, and he's just stubborn, and he holds the whole thing together. That was my model for Freya, but I wanted to start her as a young girl on the ship. And then Devi, her mom, very super intense, hardworking, brilliant, but she knows she's undereducated because she was only educated by the people on the ship in the generation before her, trying to hold the whole damn thing together and trying to understand quantum mechanics, so that she can understand ship better without having a good teacher. So I felt like I had a great set of characters there, including Badim.
Yeah, no, I thought they were wonderful. I mean, I thought Freya's development was a wonderful, I mean, both because I have kids and because I teach at a university. I mean, everyone is so obsessed with these developmental milestones. Yeah. And I mean, even your kid's goddamn height, they're like, this is how tall the kid is right now. And they need to be this tall in a year. Otherwise there's something wrong with them. Yeah. And it's not true. It's ridiculous. We've built this system of metrics of human development, which is monstrous and destructive, and we should stop it. By the same token, although or not by the same token, from the other angle, Freya and Devi struggling with things goes back to the genesis of the novel, which is you've tried to shrink the complexity of Earth, the astounding complexity of Earth, into something that fits in a metal box and can go through space and has enough to do interstellar travel. And this is us as humans, what we take for granted, the ability to breathe, the ability to have children, the ability to go in the ocean, the ability to see the sun and the moon and the stars. The science fiction novels that are less connected to what it means to be human and our evolutionary place on this planet have missed all this. And Freya is a corrective to that as well.
Yep. Yes, it's true. The jail novel, it's why Ship as narrator was so important, the comedy of the quantum computer trying to figure out how to tell a story. Balanced the horrible situation that these people are in. I was getting depressed as I began this novel because it was clearly a prison novel, and that's not fun. So that's definitely a part of it. I want to make sure that we want to talk about the slowing down in the ocean.
It's time. And, we have 10 minutes left. Let's do it.
Yeah, and let's not worry about the 10 minutes because I can actually put off what follows. But, okay, I wanted to set up this problem. They're coming back to Earth, but the way that they slowed down when they were coming into the Tau Ceti system was to blow up rocket ship fuel to decelerate. So they were trying to slow themselves down from 1/10 light speed. It took about 10 to 20 years. They had no fuel going back into Earth, and the lasers that the Earth civilization could have pointed at them to hit their sun shield and slow them down by the force of photons alone didn't show up. The future, by the time they got back, a couple few hundred years had passed on Earth and in the solar system at large, nobody was paying attention. So they're bombing on into the solar system, and I went down to NASA Ames to my friend Chris McKay and his colleagues like Larry Lemke and Carol Stoker and a few others. And we had a lunch seminar, which I'd done before for other topics. But this time I said, I need a method. Help me. My notion is this. They're coming into the solar system and they cruise around. They use gravity swings like we use in the solar system to speed up or slow down our satellites as we send them out to Jupiter or down to Venus. And so gravity swings are used already. And I said, the ship is coming in and I want it to go around, say, the sun first and then go around Jupiter and blah, blah. And they said, well, what speed did you say? And I said, a tenth of light speed. And they looked at me and they began to actually literally draw equations on the back of napkins because we were at lunch and talked it over. And Chris McKay immediately, though, said, Stan, that's like trying to stop a bullet with Kleenex. It ain't going to work. They're going to shoot right through. So they needed something else. And I said, well, how slow would the Starship have to be going for this method to work? Because we couldn't think of any other methods. And that's when they got out the napkins. And they said, well, you need it. It would probably work if they were going 1% of the speed of light. Because, of course, that's still extraordinarily fast. And you'd have to go around the sun first, Jupiter next, Saturn next, Uranus next, Neptune next, and after all those five swings, be going back to the sun, do it again, and it would take you perhaps 20 years of bombing through the solar system to slow down enough to land on Earth. I said, great, my God, this is the greatest science fiction new story. No one had ever told that story before. So I shifted the speed down by way of, they had magnetic sails, they had various things to suggest that where the ship could slow itself down partially, and I maybe had it going slower in the first place. And also, they were very smart in storytelling terms. They said, don't put the numbers in there. Not only are you likely to get them wrong, but you'll just invite argument from physicists. You don't want that. Don't give the distance from the sun. Don't give the exact speed coming in. Just describe it in general enough terms. We guarantee you it would work if everything went right. You might burn up coming that close to the sun, but you're going so fast, you probably wouldn't. And they went on and on. So I wrote it up like that. And but they said the big planets would all have to be in precisely the right configurations. So then I went to my friend Carter Scholz, who was an amateur astronomer with a computer program that shows you where the planets are going to be forward and backward in time for however long you run it. And I gave Carter where I needed the big planets to be, the big four. And I said, tell me when that will next happen. And he said, it'll happen in the year, I think, 2843. So that's why the novel ends, that's why my characters in the starship are coming back in the year 2843. It had been worked out by a computer. So when I get criticized by the so-called hard SF writers, that would never work, you know, Stan, an English major, he doesn't understand. I was furious because I couldn't really reply to them, but they were exactly completely wrong. They were the ignorant ones, and me, the English major, had thought up a new story that they hadn't thought of. So I just want to rehearse that story because it's still obviously a little irritating that they didn't bow down and say, oh my God, Stan, what a great idea, and you even worked out the details.
It's great, and it's thrilling. There's a absolutely hilarious moment where the ship is telling them how long this process is going to take, going around the sun of all the planets, and they're so worried that the ship in its quantum computer brain is going to tell them it's 5,000 years or something
It's so true. Freya is getting very irate with the ship. Just give us the answer, damn it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think the only last thing we need to talk about before we go is this, as a child growing up in Florida and with family in South Carolina, going to the beach with the Gulf of Mexico in Florida and then the Atlantic as a child. And especially you can't really body surf in the Gulf of Mexico because there's no real waves, or the Gulf of America, as I'm supposed to call it now. But, sorry for that. That wasn't necessary. But body surfing, being in the ocean, being thrown into the sand, the joy of it, the thrill, the sudden terror when you've gotten it wrong, and you feel momentarily that you will never breathe again.
Yeah.
These are some of my foundational memories. I only hope I'm able to take my kids out soon for this experience. And I've never done it in the Pacific. I've only been in the Pacific one time and I found it too cold. Finding Freya's return to Earth, to Gaia, having been described in this experience, I just found it incredibly moving, Stan. Maybe someone who doesn't have the same childhood memories won't have the same experience, but for me it was so powerful.
Thank you. I do think if you've done it, it will mean more to you. The feeling of near drowning. I was a body surfer in Orange County, California as a child and youth, and it was my passion. It was what kept me sane in Orange County, which is a very dull suburbia. But out in the ocean, you are in nature and about to get killed by it. I almost drowned three times through my childhood and youth by making stupid errors, but it's unforgiving. And that feeling that you described, that this is the last, you're not going to be able to get back to the surface and you're going to have to exhale and breathe in water, is a terrifying moment. So I wanted that. And I also wanted to describe, what if you had lived in a box all your life and you were suddenly out on the surface of the earth, that she has agoraphobia. Which Asimov had agoraphobia and didn't like to go outside. And that's why he's so good in The Naked Sun and in The Caves of Steel. He's writing from his own feeling base. These are the best novels of Asimov because he felt it. But agoraphobia would be terrifying. And I imagined her having a hard adjustment. And then at the very end of the novel, she just grabs herself and says, damn it, I'm going to get used to this planet. I'm stuck here. And I need to adjust. And she goes out into the water in the ocean, not knowing how violent it could be, and is sort of taught body surfing by an experienced body surfer who does not realize that he's effectively talking to a 200-year-old woman who's been asleep for 120 years of it. So it's like he's talking to a Rip Van Winkle type figure. And she gets thrashed. And I must say, I love that ending. And I indulged in it. I slowed down. I got some physical planetary writing in that the book hadn't really allowed, except for the dangerous moon Aurora, which was a different piece of thing entirely, more alien, more scary. But this was Earth, where you're supposed to be used to it. And, you know, we supposedly crawled out of the ocean and our blood is supposedly the same salinity as ocean water, et cetera. And it was a real pleasure to thrash her and leave her on the beach like that. And also, this is a tradition in Hawaii, body surfing. If you feel like you almost died, when you get back, you kiss the sand. It's a kind of a thank you to Gaia. So I knew I had my ending, which was given to me by my brother, who is a Hawaii body surfer of skill and renown. He's a well-known Hawaii body surfer in terms of being in contests and the like. And he told me this story. And so I have to end by saying this. Sandra Bullock in the great novel Gravity, she manages to get out of near-Earth orbit down to land and crash land, and she's into a pond or something. And I was watching this movie, and it was after I had finished Aurora, but before the book came out, or while I was still writing it, perhaps. And I was thinking, damn it, woman, you do not kiss that sand. I didn't want her to steal my ending. And so I was deadly afraid that my ending was going to be zipped by the great Sandra Bullock and the wonderful director of that movie, whose name is slipping my mind.
Cuaron, I think.
Yeah. And so so when she just stood and looked around and the movie came to an end, I was so happy.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful, Stan. The only other thing I didn't get to is, you know, I've seen people sort of connect this novel to 2312 and New York 2140, but we can talk about that in a future time, and we can talk about those books in a future time.
Yeah, that'd be fine. I'm happy to do that. And I do, we can end with this and we don't have to cut it right off, but I'll say that 2312 was my first novel for Tim Holman, my editor at Orbit Books. And that was a marvelous beginning to a marvelous association. Tim Holman gave me my 60s as a novelist in that he platformed me, he believed in me, he trusted my judgment, he gave me his judgment. And that was 2312 followed by Shaman, which I had wanted to write for years and no editor had thought was a good idea till Tim. The Paleolithic novel, then Aurora, then New York 2140, then Red Moon, my China novel, and then Ministry for the Future. So I call them the Orbit Six. Tim doesn't like that title because he wants more than six.
Seven.
But, it's the Orbit Six, and I'll hope to do more novels for Tim. I owe up to him, and I want to do them anyway. But the Orbit Six is an intellectual unit. About 10 years of my life, writing with a spur in my butt and a contractual deadline that was extremely tight, and writing 7 days a week and only taking a month break between finishing one novel and starting the next one, I felt like I was on a streak. And I like all six of those novels. And they haven't all got the same amount of attention from the world or the same amount of sales, but it's been pretty damn good in that 2312 started really strong, and along the way Aurora, New York 2140 were pretty strong, and then Ministry for the Future has been a fantastic climax to or ending to this sequence of the Orbit Six. So I don't, since they don't fit in the same world and they come from very different parts of story space, I don't exactly know how to describe it as an intellectual unit, except for, you know, where did we come from? Where are we? Where are we going? Possibly they can fit, not in a sequence, not in order, but if you took all six of them and you slotted them, where did we come from would be Shaman, and then where are we would be New York 2040 and Red Moon, and then where could we be going would be 2312. And Aurora, and well, Ministry for the Future is where are we now, and where we go in the next 30 years. So it's a mess, but it all seems to hang together for me. And it was a marvelous decade of my life, which I basically owe to Tim Holman of London, England.
All right. Well, that is the place to stop. Except I'm sure listeners, we're not done. We'll get to work on the Orbit Six, or by the time we're done, maybe it'll be the Orbit Seven. But that's something for Stan to worry about. Thank you, Stan. Yeah. Thank you so much. I just I love these conversations, and I appreciate you taking the time every year to do it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Graham. And yeah, these winters are the good time. I would be very happy to come back next year and talk about another one. It's always fun.
Let's do it. All right. Hello, it's me again. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. One last quick request for ratings and reviews for the show, especially on Apple or podcasts. 5-star ratings review or reviews, I should say. The other ones don't help the show grow, sadly. I really appreciate it. And I'm about to hit 5 years. I'm about halfway through the fifth year. And hey, let's do 5 more years of this. Why not? Oh, and of course, the music, which you already heard a little of and are about to hear more of, is by David Hill.